today we're going to celebrate Memorial Day. We're going to honor those who have given the ultimate sacrifice for us so that we can be here today and we can be speaking English instead of German and enjoying our freedoms here. One thing that bothers me is that there is an alarming number of Americans, citizens, who don't value the military and the work that the military has done. And it's frustrating to me, and they don't honor the sacrifices that have been made by the military. You remember stories back when in Vietnam times when the soldiers were coming home and they were getting spit on and cursed and all that kind of stuff. There's too many people that don't honor our military. But the Bible speaks very positively about the military. If you think about it, if you think about the passages we've covered in the Bible, some of the most honored men in the Gospels are the centurions. Jesus treats them, you know, with respect every time he talks to them. And they are mentioned positively. The whole scriptures, every time it talks about a military, it's done in an honorable way. It's never done in a shameful way or a derogatory way. Just as Christians, I believe, are part of the body of Christ, our military is part of the body of the nation, or in our case, the body of America. So it is a crucial, integral part. And they do a lot of things that I don't want to do or I can't do. And I thank them for that. So many, like I said, have selflessly given up their lives for us. They need to be honored. When I was in the Philippines a few years ago, visiting Les and Sarah Lee Tilka, who have also been here several times to our church. Gladys and Fred has been over there. One day he took me to a little section of Cebu City. It's kind of we would probably call it a slum. It was a very low-end neighborhood. And in this little neighborhood, there was a little house kind of different than the rest because it was seen to be solid and structurally built. Well, their church had built this house for a family, and he was taking me to show me the house. And I looked at the house, and I compared it to everything around it, and it was like almost like a monument compared to the shacks and the tin that they had kind of taped together they were using for house. And the house was a small house. I was looking at the stage up here behind me. It would easily fit. The whole house would easily fit on that stage and probably have room for a garden there too. So small, very little modest house. I think it was a two-bedroom house. But I was talking to Les about the house, and I looked around at everything else around there. And there was nothing in this whole section that was comparable to this house. And I said something. I forget exactly what I said to Les, but it was basically, this is nice, but you got a lot of work to do, you know? I mean, not maybe him, but there's a lot of work that needs to be done to get all the rest of these people into something as functional as this house. It was some kind of comment like that. It was like, this is a drop in the bucket type of a thing to Les. And Les said something back to me. I'll never forget it. I've thought of it many, many times. He said, Kurt, we do for one what we would like to do for everybody. And in that statement, it gave me a sense of satisfaction with what they had done. I mean, before I was looking at the whole neighborhood and saying, these needs can never be met. But after he said that, I thought, he did, for one, what he would like to do for everybody, and he was satisfied with that. Now, they also will continue to go on and do more and more and more, but they're satisfied as they go for doing for one what they want to do for many. It's kind of like Jesus. I mean, when Jesus was here, he took just a very small group of people and he poured his life into that very small group of people, and he was satisfied with that. He said that he had done the work that his father had sent him to do. So I remembered that, and I've many times as I've tried to help somebody out or whatever, and I think of the multitudes that need help, I say to myself, I'm going to do for this one person what I would like to do for everybody else. And with that, I'm satisfied. I'm content. Now, why do I tell you that story? Because there were countless thousands and thousands of Americans who made tremendous sacrifices going back to World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, you name it, that are doing things, have done things, have given the ultimate sacrifice, and even those who haven't died have sacrificed so much of their families and their health and their employment, all this kind of stuff for us. And we can't honor them all. That's the big field out there. That's the vast area of people who all deserve to be honored. But we can't do it. So what I've decided to do is to honor one person. One person who I think represents all of the masses of our military who have given so much. It's somebody you've never heard of. In fact, it's a couple. It's the man and his wife, because she sacrificed too. And I got their story from this book. Some of you may have read it or heard about it. It's called The Greatest Generation. Tom Brokaw put it together. It's basically a bunch of stories of different people and the sacrifices that they have made. And of all the multiplied thousands of people, he has picked a select few stories and put them in this one book. And out of this one book, I had just picked one person. So I want to introduce you to this person, this couple. Their name is John and Peggy Asensio, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about them. I'm going to basically read to you most of their little section in this book. I want you to get to know these two people, because they represent so many who have sacrificed for our country. There should be, there it is, a picture of John and Peggy Asensio. They have been married since a month after Pearl Harbor. He was 23 and she was 2 years younger. And they've known each other even longer. Since they were youngsters in Bensonhurst, Queens, Peggy remembers, "When I was 11, I was on my porch reading, and John threw a football to get my attention. I threw it back, and that was it." Shortly after their marriage, John was heading for basic training at Camp Pickett, Virginia. That's when this picture was taken. He was trained as a medical technician and assigned to the 118th Combat Engineers, the men who went in with the first wave to clear the minefields and bust through any defensive barriers and start a network of roads and bridges for additional troops and supplies. It was vital and dangerous work. Now at home, Peggy was a teacher in the Brooklyn Roman Catholic Archdiocese Middle School system. And during the day, she also volunteered at the Red Cross in the evening. She says, "I never went to sleep until I wrote John a letter." Those were Dear John letters you'd like to get. "I wrote every single day. I wouldn't break the routine because I thought it would keep him safe. You bet I got to know the men at the post office." Peggy also followed the progress of John's outfit through the newspapers and kept an elaborate scrapbook of everything connected to his part in the war, including newspaper clippings and his draft notice. In the Pacific, John was on the move so much that he didn't get his mail regularly. He saw action in 5 different campaigns over 23 months. His memories of Okinawa, one of the most ferocious battles of the Pacific War, still come to him in Technicolor. "We were down on our bellies, and I saw one guy, his arm flying through the air. It had been blown off. I jumped up and put a tourniquet on the stump and got him evacuated. I don't know whether he survived." John still breaks down when he recalls one excruciating close encounter. Picture this happening to you. I was on a scouting mission, crawling, when I came face to face with a Japanese soldier. He looked at me, and I looked at him. I fired first. He went down. It was a horrible, horrible experience. This is one of the things he would have nightmares about. It's all the more important to John that he won the Bronze Star for saving lives, not taking them. On November 12, 1944, at Dulag, on the Leyte Gulf, the Japanese sent a fleet of kamikaze planes to attack U.S. ships anchored in the bay. There were hundreds of casualties. John and another volunteer were on the beach where they loaded a small boat with medical supplies, and they rushed out to help the stricken ships and the wounded sailors for the next 7 hours. His breaks from combat were rare. So when he arrived in New Guinea, there were 58 letters waiting on him, most of them from Peggy. He read them in the order that they had been written, and he remembers to this day that in one of them he learned his grandfather had died. When he had left for basic training, his grandfather had assured him, "You'll come back, John, but I won't be here." And then he had kissed John. What John experienced was characteristic of the personal turmoil in the lives of young people at the time. While the men were in strange and hostile places, thousands of miles from home, from relatives, they had friends and relatives die, wives and sweethearts were left to fend for themselves, children were born, and Dear John letters were written. Sometimes it would be weeks or even months before the men would get the news, however disappointing, however sad or joyous. John's outfit was dispatched to Japan following the surrender. They were assigned to the port of Kure, just south of Hiroshima. He was stunned by what he saw in the ruins of the first target of an atomic bomb. "Hiroshima," he says, "was the most horrible thing you ever saw. Just twisted steel, complete devastation." Asensio is firmly convinced that the decision to drop the bomb was appropriate. Like most veterans of the Pacific, he believes that the Japanese would not have given up and there would have been an untold number of casualties during an invasion. One small moment during John's stay in Japan is a poignant reminder that wars are made from the top down and that the people were at the bottom. Were it left to them, they would likely find other ways to settle whatever differences existed. John said he was under strict orders, no fraternization with the locals. But one day, he and a friend passed by the home of the postmaster, the Japanese postmaster of the town of Kure. The man invited them in for tea. The postmaster could speak English. John says, "You should have seen his garden." And his little son took out a geography book and pointed to New York because that's where we were from. That next picture we have here is a picture of them sitting on the front porch with the Japanese postmaster. John is on your left. And you can see the little son dressed up in his Japanese military outfit. And then that must be the mother of the Japanese postmaster, and then John's friend on the other side. He says, "We had the most delicious tea. Never had tea that delicious. We were going against the fraternization orders," he said, "but I still had my rifle." He said, "But they were so nice." Goes on to say that just days before, the two nations, represented by the four people at that party, had been in a vicious war with each other, and the Japanese family was living in the shadow of the wreckage of Hiroshima, the single most destructive act of war ever. And here they were, entertaining two young Americans who were lucky to have survived the deadly intentions of the Japanese as they fought their way across the Pacific. Now, they were enjoying each other's company and a pot of wonderful tea. John says, "I finally got back to New York on December 30th. I missed Christmas, but I got a temporary discharge so I could spend New Year's Eve at home, or New Year's at home. I rode the train to Brooklyn with a rifle over one shoulder and a souvenir samurai sword over the other. He said, I must have looked strange. When they were courting, John and Peggy had developed a special signal so they could always find each other in crowded places like Coney Island. It was what John called his love whistle, a sweet, melodious whistle in four beats he used only when he wanted to get Peggy's attention. Karen and I have something like that. Some of you may know it. We call it the woo-hoo. So if you're ever in Walmart and you hear somebody say, woo, it's either me looking for her or vice versa. It's a great way to find. You should come up with your own little.
Cell phone works great.
Cell phone does, well. Yeah. She never has her cell phone on her. That's the problem. But she always hears the woo-hoo. Anyway, when John arrived at home at the bottom of his steps leading to his house on December 30th, a great deal had changed in his life, but he remembered how to do the love whistle. And when Peggy heard it, he says, she came running out and almost took my head off. Her memory was, I had just finished making a big welcome home sign, and I was talking to John's uncle when I heard the whistle. I just ran down the steps and hugged him. MGM could not improve on that for a love scene. And as corny as those black and white movies about love and marriage during the war years may seem now, they were a reflection of what was happening to couples across the country. Newly married couples didn't have an opportunity to adjust slowly to the complexities of suddenly sharing a life. And then they were separated often for years. Husbands were living in an intensely male environment, trying to deal with the stresses and dangers of war, while young wives were left at home, staying with relatives or living alone in strange cities, working when they could or caring for a child conceived before the father shipped out and the child was born while he was away. Still, John and Peggy Asensio were typical. When he came home, they simply resumed their life together. They loved each other. They wanted to have a family. They were faithful Catholics. They were true to the way they had been raised. They were grateful that the only lasting effect on the war, on John, was nightmares. When he went through a difficult time, thrashing around in their bed, sometimes knocking over a table lamp, occasionally sleeping on the floor to avoid hitting Peggy as he flailed out at the dark memories, she was always there to comfort him, to remind him, just by her presence, that they would get through this together. John says, the war helped me love Peggy more, if that's possible, and to appreciate her more. John went back to his old job as a salesman for an import-export firm. Peggy had saved some money from her teaching job during the war. They couldn't find an apartment in their family's neighborhood, so they bought a home on Long Island and thus became part of the fundamental alteration of the American life, the rise of the suburbs and the subsequent diffusion of the family. They raised a family, two sons. Their firstborn, John Jr., a school teacher, died of cancer a few years ago. And they've established a scholarship in his name. And his other son, Rich, is a production manager with NBC Sports. John and Peggy are proponents of women's liberation, but they worry that in trying to have it all, a career, marriage, and children, too many young women put their careers ahead of their families. Peggy, who had been a school teacher during the war, resumed teaching once the boys were in school themselves. She worries. The morals have changed tremendously, she said. The way you're told to raise your kids now, there's no discipline. This was written in the 1940s, or the quote was from the 1940s. Divorce is another issue they worry about. Peggy says young couples these days don't fight long enough. Not meaning fight with each other, fight for their marriage. It's too easy to get a divorce, she says. We've had our arguments, but we don't give up. When my friends ask whether I ever consider divorce, I remind them of the old saying, we've talked about killing each other, but divorce, never. John and Peggy are not unique within their generation. They can look back on a love affair that began in the Great Depression, was consummated at the outset of World War II, survived combat and separation, and flourished in the post-war years. They were just 21 and 23 when they were married. and they could not have imagined what strains the world would have put on their commitment to each other. But they believed their wedding vows were not conditional. Now, and this book was written, I think, about 12 years ago, in their 57th year of marriage, that belief has not diminished for John and Peggy. If anything, it has been strengthened by John's recurring memories of the horrors of combat. They come to him less often now, but Peggy is always there for him. As he says, "I relive it sometimes, but with the help of my wife and the love she has for me, that's how you get over it." These marriages and the values of the men and women who brought to them may seem curiously old-fashioned to modern young couples. They may have a difficult time relating to a love affair forged by sacrifice and separation, faith and commitment. They may not know how to measure the tensile strength such marriages bring to a society. And in an age of divorce, pagers, cell phones, and fax machines, they may never know the sweet sound of a love whistle. And that's the story of John and Peggy Cizio. There are three things that I would like to highlight from their story, and then we'll be done, that relate to Memorial Day too. The first is the horror and yet the necessity of war. It's kind of humorous to me to hear some people blurt out something like, you know, "I'm for peace," as if we're not for peace. It's really quite silly. I'm reminded of that pro football player, Pat Tillman, who many of you may remember, gave up his NFL career to join the military after 9/11. And unfortunately for Mr. Tillman, he died in the military. And I remember the sportscasters and commentators saying things like, "Oh, what a waste this is. His life was such a waste." Instead of honoring him for the patriotism that he had, they looked at it like a waste. So much of our country has their thinking totally upside down. The very men who oftentimes risk their lives for us are not being honored. And as I mentioned earlier, since the Bible speaks so positively of the military and of soldiers, that's what we're going to do too. Peace, not war, they say. I don't believe in war, so therefore I don't want soldiers around. That's so stupid. That's like saying, "I don't believe in crime, so I don't want any policemen around." It's just on a bigger scale, but it's exactly the same thing. They're not thinking. And fortunately, there's not enough of them to totally destroy our country, because if everybody thought that way, we wouldn't have a country anymore. There are bad people in our country, and there's bad people outside our country. And it is the job of the military to deal with the bad people outside of our country. And if they didn't do their job, they would invade us. We would be conquered. We would become subject to another nation. Even today, it would still happen. Thomas Jefferson had a wonderful quote. I'm sure you've heard it. He says, "The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants." What am I saying? I'm saying that war is a necessity. Military is a necessity. If there weren't any bad people, it wouldn't be a necessity, but they are. So we just need to understand that in our thinking, our logical thinking, and understand that it is a requirement for a society to have a military and a strong military. Now, I talked about the necessity of war, but there's also horrors of war that I mentioned. And that's just a fact. One of the things that is a horrible thing about war is that there are good people on both sides in any war. And just like John talked about him crawling up on the Japanese soldier, you remember, and having to shoot. We don't know anything about that Japanese soldier. We don't know if he was a good man. We know that the Japanese people were forced to go into the military by an imperial government. And but we don't know if he was a good man, and John didn't know, and perhaps that's why he had nightmares, not knowing if he killed a good man. That's one of the horrors of war. C.S. Lewis made a statement I remembered from one of his books. He said this, "I have often thought to myself how it would have been if when I served in the First World War and some young German and I had killed each other simultaneously and found ourselves together a moment after death. I cannot imagine that either of us would have felt any resentment or even any embarrassment. I think we might have laughed over it." That's from the book Mere Christianity. War has horrors, but yet it is necessary. That's the first point. Second point I wanted to make is the value of a strong and lasting marriage to our society. And that's one reason I picked John and Peggy, because of their commitment to each other. She says in the book that there is value to everybody in a steadfast marriage. And that's something that I don't think we often focus on when we're having a fight with our spouse, having trouble in our marriage. We just think of how it affects us. We don't think how it affects everybody else. And when any couple gets divorced, it does damage to the fabric of our society as a whole. And the more divorces are, the more holes there are in that fabric. And I think we as Christians should be mindful of that and fight for our marriages, just like John and Peggy did during their tough times, and be strong in our marriages, not just for what it does for us and does for our spouse, but what it does for everybody else. If you think of it as part of your testimony. You would not intentionally damage your own testimony, your Christian testimony. You wouldn't do that and cause somebody else to be impacted by it. Same way with your marriage. Look at your marriage as part of your testimony. The third thing is the value of a soldier's sacrifice. I had a nightmare Friday night. Kind of woke up in a cold sweat. I'll tell you, it was real short. I was in this house, and the place was just very, very messy. I mean, there was food and clothes and junk on the floor, and everything, furniture was tipped over, and it looked like, you know, a tornado had gone through there. And I was assigned the task of cleaning up the house. And I'm trying to pick up things and put it back in drawers, and every time I do something, something else happens, and the mess gets even greater. And the harder I work, the more messy the house gets. That was my nightmare. For somebody who likes to be an organized person, a messy house is a nightmare. And I woke up frustrated at it. And then I read this story, and I thought about John's nightmares. Nightmares of pointing a gun right at somebody's head, killing them. Seeing arms and legs blown off and things like that. And I realized it's because of what he did that my nightmares are limited to a messy house. I didn't have to deal with the things that he did. So it goes back to us appreciating the sacrifice of the soldiers, because what they do allows us to live the way we live, to have picnics today and tomorrow, and just enjoy Memorial Day. So that was the story. Those are the three things I wanted to follow up on, and I have one little postscript to the story. After I finished reading this and kind of putting together the message, I thought, I wonder if there's a chance that John and Peggy are still alive. I went back and looked, and they were 23 in 1940, so that would make them right around 100 years old. And I said, I doubt there's any chance they're alive. So I did a little research on the internet, and I found a letter on the internet. If Dave can put this up there. This is a letter that was found on the internet. And as you can see, it's written from Christine Goloszewski, Aunt Peggy, and that would be the Peggy here, and Richie, that's her son, how saddened I am to learn from Eileen Dolan, living in Florida, that Uncle John passed away. Your family was and continues to be family to me. I have such wonderfully fond memories of all of you, and especially Johnny. Aunt Peggy, you take good care of yourself. Richie, take care of your mother, especially now. With thoughts of love and great sadness, Christine. Now, that was written in 2004. And then I looked around. I did not see any obituaries or anything for Peggy. Wondered again if she might still be alive, but again, I thought, well, she's going to be 100 too. But I did. I was looking. I knew that they were from the New York area, so I was looking around, and I found a phone number in New York City for a Peggy Asensio. And I thought, I wonder if it's the same one. And so I called the number up, A guy answers the phone, and I said, "Is Peggy there, please?" And he said, "Who's this?" I said, "My name's Kurt Bomar." And he didn't want to tell me anything. And I said, "Well, I'm a pastor in North Carolina. And I just read her story, or read the story of Peggy and John in the book. And I'm wondering if this is the same Peggy." And he said, "It is." And he says, "She's now 98 years old. And she's still alive. And she's sitting next to me. Would you like to talk to her?" I said, "I'd love to talk to her." She was very sharp, or clear, speaking. Got her on the phone. I told her who I was. I said, "Miss Peggy, we're at our church tomorrow. We're going to have a Memorial Day service. And I just randomly picked one couple who made a sacrifice for our country. And you and your husband was the one I picked." And she said, "Well, my husband died." I said, "Yeah, I know. I found it." I said, "But I wanted to talk to you to thank you for your service. Thank you for your husband's service, and Richie, who was also listening on the phone. Richie, thank you for your dad's service." And they said for me to tell you here at Walnut Grove to please pass on their blessings to you, to thank us for honoring them and all. So I just thought that was remarkable. I'll bet you that very well may be the only living person in that whole book that's left. There may be a few, but certainly not many, that have reached 100 years old. So they both send their blessings to our church. And then I left off by telling them this. I said, "You know, we have a church website." And I gave them the website address. I said, "If you would like, you can go online and you can hear this tribute to John sometime, probably Monday or Tuesday, whenever Dave gets it up there." They were excited about that. Richie took down the website, and he said, "Yes, we are going to listen to it." So, to Peggy and Richie, who are listening now, we thank you for your service to our country and the service of John. And finally, by honoring John, we say that we do for you, Richie and Peggy, what we would like to do for many. So thank you very much. And I would like to close now by having us all stand and recite the Pledge of Allegiance in honor of John and Peggy. And also, after that, Bud, you can lead us in our closing hymn. So if you will, just join me in standing. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.